My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform, and I want to welcome you on behalf of our chairman, Jay Rockefeller, our co-chair, Susan Collins, and the other members of our board of directors, to a briefing on a topic that goes right to the heart of equity and fairness in our healthcare system, and that is the role that Medicare plays and could play in reducing racial, ethnic, and income disparities in healthcare. Our partner today is the National Academy for Social Insurance, which is, for those of you who are not familiar with them, a nonpartisan group of which, as a matter of fact, I am a member and Carolyn Clancy is a member, in the interest of full disclosure. NACI often convenes prestigious panels to look at policy questions involving social insurance programs. And on this occasion, the task was to examine how Medicare can help us move toward a solution to the persistent problem of disparities in healthcare. Medicare is the biggest single healthcare program in the country, and the view of the panel, among other things, is that it needs to lead the way in moving us toward greater equity and fairness. I want to thank NACI, Pam Larson, Paul Vandewater, Jill Bronstein, the rest of the folks, for its active participation in putting together today's program and its partial support of the briefing. And I should say, their annual conference is later this week, so I know how difficult it has been for a small-staffed nonprofit to handle two very important meetings at the same time. And on behalf of NACI, let me reiterate the acknowledgments that are printed at the bottom of today's agenda. NACI's work on disparities has been supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, by the California Endowment, and by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. And on behalf of NACI, let me say thank you to those folks. I should say that the issue brief from the Alliance on this topic that's in your materials was also supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So we're very pleased to have them actively involved in this issue. A couple of logistical items before we go on. In your packets, of course, a bunch of materials that are relevant, including speaker biographies that are more extensive than I'm going to have time to give them, and copies of the slides that we had received in time to include them. By tomorrow, you'll be able to view a webcast of this briefing on kaisernetwork.org, along with electronic versions of the materials in your kits and the copies of the slides that we didn't get in time to include therein. And in a few days, there'll be a transcript that you can take a look at as well. At the appropriate time, you're going to want to fill out those green cards and ask tough questions of our panel or come to one of the microphones and ask them in person. And at the end of the briefing, we would very much appreciate your filling out the blue evaluation form so that we can make improvements in these programs as we go along for you. We have an extremely distinguished panel of speakers today, so if you would turn your cell phones and pagers to vibrate or whatever you need to do, I want to get started. First off, Dr. Carolyn Clancy. Dr. Clancy has been directing the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality for almost 4 years now. Her academic and professional credentials are immensely impressive, as set out in her bio, and her expertise on matters of healthcare quality is recognized worldwide. She's been responsible for producing ARC's annual reports on quality and on disparities as directed by Congress since their inception. The newest editions of those two reports are summarized in your materials. She's also, I'm pleased to say, a veteran of a number of Alliance programs, and we're very pleased to have you with us today, Carol.
Thank you, Ed. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm also very pleased to be here because you're hearing news that is almost hot off the press. So we released the 2006 versions of the National Healthcare Quality Report and the National Healthcare Disparities Report on January 11th. There's a huge amount of information in both reports, and I couldn't begin to cover it here, although I'd be willing to stay till midnight if people want to hear all of the details. I'm going to just hit some of the highlights with respect to disparities today. Before going there, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background about why are we doing these reports. When the agency was reauthorized in late 1999, we were directed by the Congress to produce on an annual basis two reports, and the literal legislative language is up here. To start in fiscal year 2003, the Secretary, acting through the Director of ARC, shall submit to the Congress an annual report on national trends in the quality of health care provided to the American people. And the second report charged us to track prevailing disparities in health care delivery as it relates to racial factors and socioeconomic factors in priority populations. Now, this last sentence clause is very, very important because some people hear the word disparities and they think it's about race and ethnicity only. The mandate to us actually is much, much broader than that and has to include not only income and education but geography and other factors as well. So the question is, why are these reports useful? We believe that it gives the Congress a very high-level view of what's happening in the American healthcare system on an annual basis. And because these reports are produced annually, you can actually see progress or, in some cases, the lack thereof over time, which gives you a sort of deeper and richer understanding than you might get from a single study, because we're using the same measures year after year. Now, the quality report this year has 211 measures, but in order to make this more digestible, we have 40 core measures that we track over time. And it gives us a sense of where we're going. We can actually give national and state trends from 1994 on. And we're also hoping that this helps us advance what I think is a national agenda in aligning measurement activities. These days, there's no shortage of quality report cards. Sometimes you might could argue that we have too many. There's a great deal of interest in the public and private sectors in aligning around a core set of measures, and we think that these reports can help facilitate that alignment. So, the disparities report provides a snapshot of disparities across multiple domains in this country, whereas the quality report provides an overview of quality of care. The disparities report focuses on quality and access. The quality report, obviously, on quality. I want to make the point, though, that they're the same quality measures in both reports, and we've linked them very closely for one very important reason. Achieving equity in getting to only okay care didn't seem to us to be a terribly lofty goal in terms of reducing or eliminating disparities associated with patient characteristics. In other words, if you think about Beth McGlynn's famous report saying that Americans receive recommended care 55% of the time, achieving equity at that level of care didn't seem terribly ambitious to us. So that's why we think it's very important to link the two very closely. The quality report focuses on four of the six dimensions of quality that have been recognized by the Institute of Medicine, and I must say I'm always intrigued, are now referred to very broadly by people who don't follow the technical details. So you often hear employers and healthcare purchasers talk about the IOM-6. So the quality report focuses on safety, effectiveness, timeliness, and patient-centeredness. The disparities report focuses very broadly on equity. Neither report as yet focuses on efficiency. The disparities report focuses on variation across populations, whereas the quality report gives us some sense of variation across states. So I will take 2 seconds for a public service announcement to say we will be having state reports, state snapshots coming out in March. New in these reports are a focus on obesity, hospice care, adverse drug events, communication in the hospital, workforce diversity in response to the recommendations put forth by the commission led by Secretary Sullivan, and language assistance. There are some specific composite measures that speak to postoperative complications, as well as composite measures related to communication in the hospitals. Some of you are aware that HCAHPS, or a standard survey of patients' experience of care in the hospitals, will be reported publicly for the first time by virtually all hospitals in this country later this year. You'll get to see a preview of what that looks like in those hospitals that participated early, not at the individual hospital level, but at a high-level view. And we also have more trends and information on Hispanic subpopulations. So, for the quality report, we found that improvements are being seen. We're headed in the right direction. That's the good news. The slightly less good news is that the overall improvement rate is relatively modest at 3%. headed in the right direction, but my statistician tells me it will take us about 20 years at that rate to close the gap between best possible care and the care that's routinely provided. The use of proven preventive strategies seem to us to be a very, very important set of opportunities to highlight as we published the reports a couple of weeks ago. Specifically, just over half of all adults report receiving recommended colorectal cancer screening. Really, really important, because if we don't find it early, it's not curable. Only 58% of obese adults were given advice about exercise from their doctor, and just under half of adults with diabetes receive all their recommended screenings. Let me just pause and reemphasize the point about trends here. You could look at 48% and say, what is going on in healthcare? On the other hand, in our first report in 2003, that number was 32%. So we're definitely seeing improvement in the right direction, but it's clear that we have to accelerate that trend even more than has been done to date. The disparities report finds that disparities in care associated with patient race and ethnicity and income and education persist. Blacks, Hispanics, and the poor are worse off on 75% of quality measures. Asians and American Indians are worse off on 40% of quality measures. Hispanics and the poor are worse off on 90% of access measures. And blacks and Asians are worse off on 1/3 of access measures. So just to give you a sense of what this looks like, what you can see on the left-hand side of this slide are, in order, are black versus white, Asian versus white, and American Indian and Alaska Native versus white. So the yellow bar that's circled there are the proportion of areas where disparities are improving. The pink bar is where the disparities are staying the same. And that aqua bar, you can speak to me about colors if I've got them wrong later, are areas where the disparities are actually increasing. And you can also see that for the poor, 25% of disparities are actually improving, but almost 2/3 are worsening. Similarly, if you look at access, most disparities in access seem to be getting smaller, which is good news. In particular, you can see that 80% of access measures for American Indians and Alaska Natives are improving. On the other hand, for Hispanics, that's only 20%, and for the poor, only 40%. Now, to say that opportunities for improvement remain, I think, is self-evident, so I don't want to dwell on that. All groups are worse off on some measures of care covering multiple domains, and moreover, all groups are worse off on some measures of care where the gap is growing larger. So there's no shortage of areas where we could bring focused efforts. We believe very strongly that solutions need to be tailored to local communities. We're giving, our disparities report is providing a very high-level overview, a little bit like flying in an airplane over the country's healthcare system, if you could picture that. But in terms of getting down on the ground, it's reasonable to think that the needs of one community are going to be quite different from the needs of another. So an awful lot of our work at ARC is focused on trying to figure out how can we create and implement effective partnerships with people who want to improve care. So by way of example, we're working with a number of states to reduce disparities in pediatric asthma. We also see that the information is improving, but we still have some gaps. This year specifically, estimates were not possible for most quality measures for Pacific Islanders and individuals who identify themselves as being of multiple races. And in addition to that, we weren't able to provide reliable estimates for 60% of quality measures for American Indians and the poor. Just some very specific snapshots. What you're looking at here are disparities in black Medicare beneficiaries for postoperative care complications. You see total white and then black moving across the slide. You can see there's been improvements in all, but black rate remains higher than whites. Similarly, disparities in Hispanic Medicare beneficiaries for any type of colorectal cancer screening in the past 2 years. And what you can see are some areas where there's a very high prevalence of Hispanic populations. And you can see here that in general, whites are doing a whole lot better than Hispanics. The purple bar is total. The brown bar in the middle is the rate for whites, and the whitish bar is for Hispanics. You can also see that the high water mark here is for whites in Miami, Florida, which is 22%, which is way, way lower than it should be. Similarly, disparities among Medicare beneficiaries, you can see, vary a lot by income, with those in the highest income groups having the highest rates. We see this for a lot of measures, and we also see that in other countries. Disparities in appropriate timing of antibiotics received among Medicare patients who are having surgery. This makes a huge difference in terms of the incidence of postoperative infections. And what you can see is that the total's about 57%. No significant differences between whites, blacks, and Asians. Starts to be a little bit lower for American Indians and lower at 49% for Hispanics. And I might be stuck here. Oops. Well, that was just the end. So let me just say in conclusion, thank you for your attention, and also to tell you that you can get to much, much more information on our website. And Ed said I was responsible for leading these reports. I would say I'm responsible for taking credit. The two experts who really do the hard work are also here with me today, so I'd be happy to hook you up with them as well. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. Terrific basis for our discussion. I'm going to continue building that base, if you will, with our next speaker, Renee Landers. I am definitely not the next speaker. Renee Landers is one of those people whom people like me are in awe of. She's a law professor at Suffolk Law School in Boston, where she teaches, among other things, health law. She's been a senior official in both the Justice Department and at HHS. She's practiced law in one of the most prominent private firms in the country, Ropes and Gray. And not coincidentally, Professor Landers was a member of the study panel on Medicare and disparities that was convened by the National Academy for Social Insurance, the report that occasions our gathering here today. And we're very pleased to have you with us.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ed. I really appreciate being here and having the opportunity to talk about the NASI report on what Medicare can do to reduce racial and ethnic disparities in health and healthcare. Ed did a fantastic job of talking about the mission of NASI to promote understanding and good public policy on social insurance issues, which include things such as economic security and access to health care, which is the reason that we're here today. On the panel on racial and ethnic disparities, just to emphasize the point that NASI tries to convene study panels that represent a diverse range of disciplines and perspectives to bring to bear on thinking about these complicated problems that in some ways seem to be intractable from time to time. The study panel's report, which I think is in your packets, is just a part of the work product of the study panel. We also commissioned some working papers and briefs, which are you have one of them in their packet, but also the working papers are available on the NASI website. As Carolyn noted, I think it's not terribly, it's not news to anyone that there are disparities in healthcare and health outcomes in this country, because they've been documented again and again, not only by the National Healthcare Disparities Report, but also by the IOM studies and the work of people on this panel. And the study panel's goal was to really try to determine how Medicare could help reduce disparities, because Medicare, as has been noted, is the largest purchaser of healthcare services in the country and has tremendous influence on all components, therefore, of the healthcare system, not only for the program's beneficiaries, but for the public generally, and how the public experiences healthcare. I indicated, Medicare finances care for 43 million beneficiaries, 9 million of whom qualify as members of some racial or ethnic minority group. One of the important premises that the panel started from was that as a contributory social insurance program, Medicare really has the responsibility, the obligation, from a legal point of view and also from the point of view of how a government program should function in a democracy, to ensure that all beneficiaries receive the appropriate care on a fair and non-discriminatory basis. I think one of the first things that we thought it was important to do in our report was to acknowledge that the Department of Health and Human Services has made really quite a substantial amount of progress. Historically, as our report notes, Medicare was instrumental in eliminating segregation in hospitals, legally sanctioned segregation in hospitals in America. And more recently, the healthcare disparities report that AHRQ prepares, CMS demonstration projects on cancer prevention and treatment, being a notable one that is aimed at eliminating racial and ethnic disparities in the delivery of care, the quality improvement organizations, and partnerships with health plans and provider organizations are all the kinds of things that Medicare is trying to do to really address this question of disparities. Some of the partnerships are worth noting, the partnerships with the NCQA and with health plans directly, and some of the organizations representing minority health professionals are all things that CMS has done or is contemplating in the future doing to try to focus on this question of eliminating disparities, and also focusing on and collecting improved data. Carolyn noted in her talk that the data is a barrier to trying to get a handle on what the extent of the problem is and what the right solutions are, and I think that CMS is aware that that's an issue. But I think that we all also thought that there was more that could be done by Medicare to produce an improvement in disparities and to reduce disparities. By definition, Medicare has overcome one of the major factors contributing to disparities, which is access to insurance. People in the Medicare population, that sort of access to some basic coverage is not their issue. But disparities persist, and I think one of our goals was to talk about ways in which Medicare could really use its leverage to try to and its activities to try to reduce these disparities. One of the visions that the panel had was that we wanted that equity of access of all beneficiaries was really important, that all beneficiaries should have access to providers with whom they could communicate effectively, that providers needed to understand how culture affects health and health care, and that health care that is responsive to individual needs and is appropriate under the circumstances is really what the system should be driving to produce. And we also thought that, as with all programs targeting improvements for minority populations, these improvements will provide information and improvements for the program, the Medicare program overall. And then finally, one of my personal goals was, which is not on the slide, was to communicate a sense of urgency about this problem, that it's very undermining in a democratic system where people contribute to fund the Medicare program through payroll deductions, taxes, that these disparities persist, and it does not reflect well on the nation, among the Western democracies, that these disparities continue to exist. So to get to the report, we made recommendations in five categories: quality of clinical care, access to care, education of health professionals, the capability and practice of institutions, and administrative priorities and structure. And I'll highlight one or two of the recommendations in each category in the interest of time, and then if you want to go back over some of the other ones, we can talk about them during the discussion. But the slides provide a list of all the recommendations in each category. On the quality issue, I think the most significant feature to point out here is that quality improvement efforts should focus explicitly on reducing disparities. The members of the study panel felt strongly that efforts to improve quality overall do help at the margins eliminate or reduce disparities, but usually there needs to be a much more targeted focus in order to see changes in the disparities, improvement there. And in fact, some efforts to improve quality may worsen disparities, and I can talk a little bit more about that. On the quality of care, one of the major recommendations of the report is that Medicare should work very hard to ensure that beneficiaries have a primary provider of care. This is a common theme, I think, throughout a lot of the literature on disparities, that having a healthcare provider that a beneficiary sees regularly, can consult with, and that person can help coordinate the other care they're receiving is incredibly important to eliminating disparities and improving access. One of the other recommendations in this area is thinking about structuring incentives to improve quality, and that these incentives, we have to be careful here, as the literature has pointed out, in structuring the incentives so that they don't have some perverse effect of actually exacerbating disparities as providers try to make their numbers look good and to improve their numbers. And this is one of the concerns I have. I come from Massachusetts, as Ed indicated, where we've just enacted this new health care reform legislation to try to improve coverage, insurance coverage, for large numbers of the uninsured in Massachusetts. And there's a provision for providing incentives to providers to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities, and I think it'll be very crucial to see how those incentives end up being structured so that we don't exacerbate the problem we're trying to solve. On access to care, one of the recommendations of the report was to make sure on the parts of the Medicare programs where there are deductibles and co-payments that Medicare really be cognizant of socioeconomic status and try to set deductibles and co-payments to reduce disparities so that people can have access to those other parts of the Medicare program. And also to improve education to beneficiaries and to their families about healthcare and about using the healthcare system. One of the other projects I'm involved on in Boston is the Medical Legal Advocacy Program at Boston Medical Center, which has for a number of years now had lawyers who are employed by the pediatrics department, and physicians can refer patients to the lawyers. It's not intended to generate more malpractice litigation, so don't worry about that. But recognizing that problems with housing, benefits, insurance, education, or employment for the parents or the children can have tremendous impact on the ability of people to take advantage of their access that they have to the healthcare system. And these lawyers are on site and have improved. So that's just one example of the kind of thing that programs, that the Medicare program could think about doing. This is not in our report, but it's the kind of thing that isn't necessarily intuitive, but that could really actually work to improve healthcare status and access to healthcare by thinking about what are the contributing factors to healthcare status and problems with access to healthcare. Education of professionals is another major focus of our report. Obviously, there's a lot of literature about encouraging and enhancing training on cultural competence for providers. We talk about, really thinking about institutions, thinking about how many people in the institution really are conversant in foreign languages. I have a college friend who went to medical school in Montreal, for example, and it was just assumed that it was her problem to learn French sufficiently to deal with patients who would come into the hospital when she was in her training and part of her training programs. And so I think that emphasis on that and training of all professionals, but medical professionals, is incredibly important. The capability and practice of institutions, I think, again, as I mentioned earlier and as Carolyn alluded to, that collecting data necessary for assessing and monitoring and targeting disparities is really important. Right now, there are a lot of weaknesses in the data, especially on as Carolyn noted, really specific data and sufficient quantities about people who identify themselves as multiracial. Some of the data are not very good for some of the smaller racial and ethnic minority groups. And the data on economic status that can be correlated with the racial and ethnic data is also not very good. And our report recommends that several steps that Medicare and the Social Security Administration could take to try to improve the quality of the data. And obviously, you know, as new people enroll in the program, the Medicare program, there's an opportunity to start fresh in collecting really the kinds and range of data that the program needs. But also, I think the Medicare program needs to really try to collect that same level of quality data from existing beneficiaries. Otherwise, it's another problem that's 20, 30, 40, or 50 years in the solution. On administrative priorities and structure, their report makes several recommendations that CMS ought to identify performance goals for reduction of disparities. It has some of these demonstration projects and other kinds of programs that are attempting to do that, but to really raise the profile of addressing this issue within CMS and to really try to enhance the organizational structure that CMS has brought to bear on this issue, because I think it's one of the issues that, you know, out of sight, out of mind. If it's everyone's responsibility, it tends not to be anyone's direct responsibility, and I think that that's basically the thrust of the recommendations of the report, to really identify officials within CMS for whom this would be a specific priority. So in sum, I would say what I said at the beginning, that Medicare and CMS are beginning to use the tools available to help reduce disparities, that Medicare, the CMS, needs to use all the tools because I don't think there's any, this is not the kind of issue where there is any one solution to a very persistent and pervasive problem. And what's needed are a commitment, energy, and additional resources. I personally would have thought that in the 40 years since the beginning of the real active civil rights movement in the United States, that some of these problems would not be persistent in our culture, but they remain. And at some point, we have to adopt a sense of urgency in order to really try to make them go away. So thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer questions later.
Thanks very much, Renee. When we turn for our final presentation to Peter Bach. For almost 2 years, ending in last November, Dr. Peter Bach was a senior advisor to the administrator of CMS, where he handled a lot of questions related to quality and quality-related payment and the evidence base for treatments. He's one of the country's most respected researchers in the areas of quality variations and care disparities, among other topics. And obviously, that is an invaluable focus for us to have, given our topic for today. And Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's a nice thing to say. So I get the pleasure of talking about this topic I care about greatly, and also the pleasure, I think, of disagreeing on a few of the points. Put simply, and to get back to Carolyn's slides for a second, there is sometimes a math problem with addressing the sort of shortfall in quality that we have and the disparity gaps that we face. And I think we do sort of have to accept the algebra around this, and there's a reason I'm being this technical, that it is possible that we could put programs in place that would widen disparities while increasing the quality of care achieved or received by both groups, if you're comparing, let's say, blacks and whites. And I think that if forced, and if you put an administrative structure like CMS around something like quality improvement or disparities reduction, and there are targets and goals put in place, if forced to reconcile potential problems with that algebra or potential problems of widening disparities by improving net quality, we will, or CMS will have to decide, or the secretary will have to decide how one set of progress is weighed against what would otherwise be viewed as a failure on the other end. And that's a really hard problem, I think, just in the pedestrian, technocratic sense of running a major agency that's charged with the care, or at least the insurance and coverage for 43 million people. So it's an intriguing problem, and it's real. And on some of those slides, there were actually widenings of gaps when the, even as the boat, if you will, was rising for all. Same goes with this recent Trivedi study in JAMA. It's very clear that in some of the MA plans, there's sort of net improvements and net widening of gaps all at the same time. And I guess my personal view of this is if forced to choose, I would go for quality improvement over a reduction in disparities that doesn't sort of make the whole improve. Because I view disparity, focus on disparities specifically as trying to get a better ticket to a bad movie. And I think what we need really is trying to get a better movie. And then maybe we can get ever better tickets for everyone as well. So I think that that's one of the challenges in an agency trying to focus on both. Another is that Medicare, obviously a very large payer responsible for paying almost a million providers and the care of all, you know, tens of millions of beneficiaries, Medicare through its demonstration authority and through other sorts of vehicles like voluntary reporting and even vehicles like hospital quality reporting is pretty good at targeting specific conditions, specific patient subgroups, specific measures, process measures, structural measures, and even capable through some sorts of steps and conditions of participation around hospitals of mandating particular types of behavior or resources are present. But there isn't a lot of runway to pursue something like really looking at making sure that care is, let's say, equitable or care is fair or it achieves a certain standard for all beneficiaries, because the issues of defining such things are so vexing. And there are a lot of different ways of doing it. And so although that makes sense sort of hypothetically as an administrative function, would be very, very difficult to do, I think. I do think, to differ with one of the points on the slide, that one of the ways to do that is to focus on evidence-based medicine. And there are lots of areas in healthcare where the evidence is insufficient. There's no question, and there's different estimates floating around, but it's probably the majority of processes that aren't thoroughly based in available evidence, and there isn't evidence to support them necessarily. But there's certainly a raft of emerging measures, many of which were on the slides just now from Carolyn, of things that are evidence-based and that Medicare can continue to focus on, and through demonstration authorities and cancer, you know, 2006, for example, Medicare asked doctors to specifically state if they were following evidence-based guidelines in the care of cancer patients. And such an approach of sort of getting doctors to adhere to evidence should at least drive consistency of care. And given that all of the measures we look at are focused on those evidence-based guidelines, should drive improvements in quality as well. So I think there's places to go there through the quality direction. But I do think we have to be careful. Even if Medicare could be highly successful at these things, we have to be careful at appreciating sort of the amount of variation, if you will, that is attributable to the healthcare system and can be manipulated by or improved by a payer, even a very large payer like Medicare, even if followed by all the private payers or in conjunction with the private payers. Much of this data, some of which I've been lucky enough to work on, demonstrates that there are disparities in healthcare, and the most important variable is the one that's sort of controlled for and accounted for before we start to look at race, and that's socioeconomic status. And the presence of insurance, whether you have supplemental insurance or not, or adequate coverage of your copay in Part B or whatever it is, the sort of stubborn challenges that poverty play extend far beyond the brick walls of healthcare institutions or physician offices. And although Medicare should be able to drive the sorts of quality improvements it's trying to drive, the extent of its scope is far narrower than the sort of underlying cultural problems that have to be addressed. And so although I'm ambitious, and I was at the agency, that Medicare should be a leader on this, I think there has to be a reasonable set of expectations around the goals that could be achieved simply through a large social insurance program like this. The next culprit, probably after socioeconomic status, is geographic or between provider or between facility contribution as opposed to within provider, within facility contribution. And I think the data support that idea that maybe the biggest problems that minorities are facing in healthcare has to do with the door they walk into when they receive it, as opposed to the treatment they get within that facility as compared to other individuals who are, let's say, white or not members of minority groups. And that becomes a structural issue, one not necessarily well addressed through things like cultural competency training or other things like that, where the underlying tenet is that doctors or other healthcare providers are discriminating against one group of patients versus another. It's more likely, and the data suggests at least, that what's going on is people enter facilities where the ambient quality of care is lower. Certainly some of Carolyn's slides, times to antibiotics after surgery or prior to surgery, are very unlikely to vary based on the race of the patient due to something like discrimination. That's a process within a hospital. It's very unlikely to be heavily influenced by the skin color or the ethnic background of a patient, I believe. That said, some of the other things Medicare is doing to improve quality do need particular attention so that, as Renee pointed out, they don't exacerbate disparities. If we're going to have pay for performance, and I think that's where we're headed that way, we have to decide how we're going to measure that performance. It'll have to be some sort of change against something else. And whether or not that's an absolute rate of performance, an absolute improvement, a performance this year divided by the performance last year, or whatever it is, the algebra around that equation will drive provider behavior. And I think it is important to ask questions, given sort of the other issues, stubborn challenges of poverty, lower quality of facilities available to minorities, some of the other challenges with resources available in local communities, whether or not P4P should be directly risk adjusted based on the racial, ethnic, or socioeconomic makeup of patients who are being treated. Such a thing is basically being done in the United Kingdom under the deprivation payment system. Medicare has direct tools for doing that either through P4P or could use other sorts of resources like a modified version of the DISH system that's used in hospitals, like the health professional shortage area payment that's currently used to mostly deal with rural areas. But there are other sort of mechanisms at Medicare's disposal which could create greater financial incentives and perhaps buff up infrastructures in poor and minority communities, and that could yield benefits directly. And I think that kind of direction is worth thinking about. One other comment. For P4P to work in hospitals, and you can view the recent article in the New England Journal as evidence that Premier is outperforming hospitals that are just doing quality reporting, or you can view it as Premier is not doing that much better, depending on whether or not you focus on the size of the gap that's closed or the size of the gap that was attacked. But either way, it's quite easy, it's not that easy, but in hospitals to identify what the accountable unit is. It's the hospital. So the patient goes in the door, patient comes out the door on the other side, and during that period, the hospital is the accountable unit. We don't have that in the physician side in Medicare, at least in the indemnity program. What we have, if you imagine a medical home or a marriage between doctor and patient, what we have is some strange form of polygamy in the healthcare system where patients are married to, thanks, Ed. The patients are, you should have warned them that I'd say something. But patients tend to see different physicians, many of them. The IOM report on P4P focused, I think, on the number seven, being a number of different unique providers that Medicare beneficiaries see in any particular year to receive their services. So if we're going to hold doctors or practices accountable and we're going to credit them for increasing the ambient quality in their practice or the quality of care provided to a particular patient, we better have a way of assigning those patients to the doctors, and we better have a way that the doctors feel that they have enough of a toehold in that patient's care that they can influence it. And right now, the current structure of fee-for-service Medicare is not compatible with that. So the idea of a medical home, although absolutely evidence-based and theoretically makes sense, has nothing to do with how fee-for-service Medicare works right now. And I'm not sure that CMS has the authority to require it. It may be something that can be done under demonstrations, but even in the physician group practice demo, there is no such requirement or even structure around it. It's a post hoc calculation of whose home belongs to whom. The last comment is that I view language barriers to be one of the most serious challenges in the application of clinical care. I speak only one language, and I don't speak it well, but the patients I see at Sloan Kettering speak lots and lots of different languages. And the patients I saw at other places I worked, Johns Hopkins and University of Chicago, same goes. It is very difficult to access language services. It's uncertain how qualified they are. Accessing such services is a major impediment to the chaotic flow of clinical care. And I do think that that is something where we already have standards in place that are probably just not adequately enforced. And that would be a place where I would see a real potential for improvement, although we have to acknowledge that similarly, it will greatly drive up the costs of care to have more rigorous enforcement of translation requirements and things like that. But I do think it will be very important in terms of the care of patients in terms of the ability of providers to have satisfactory long-term relationships with patients and help them manage their chronic diseases if we had adequate translation services. I don't think we can expect doctors, for example, to learn the, for me, would be probably about 6 or 7 languages that I would have to deal with working in New York City. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter. Now you have a chance to ask some questions, and what I'd like to do is to give our other panelists a chance to respond to what I think is a very provocative and useful entry into this topic, and I would invite comments from both Carolyn and Renee, particularly with respect to Peter's observations, and actually Renee's as well, about the possibility that making overall quality improvements might actually worsen disparities. In other words, by putting money into a better script, you're going to make sure people get worse seats to that movie. And whether that holds for an overall strategy or if there is a way that one can steer between the difficulties on both shores of that dilemma. Carolyn?
Well, let me start off with a strong belief statement, and I'll follow that with an empirical statement. So the belief statement is, in healthcare, we can be equal and excellent too, period. The empirical statement is we can't have excellence in healthcare unless we are providing equitable care. It just simply won't work given the changing demographics of this country. If we have disparities for certain subpopulations, we can't possibly get to the kind of excellence in healthcare that we all want for ourselves. It's simply not going to happen. There have been areas where a targeted focus purely on quality improvement actually was associated with a significant reduction in disparities, and the clearest example that comes to mind is in the end-stage renal disease program. So very serious focused efforts on improving care for people on dialysis led to overall improvements and significant reductions in disparities associated with race, in this case African-American, and gender. So that's the good news. The not so good news is our reports show every year really suboptimal quality for controlling hypertension, diabetes, and the other factors that get you a ticket into the end-stage renal disease program. So it's very clear that we need to move upstream. And I think some of what Peter had to say about the accountable unit issue starts to become a little bit worrisome. The article in your booklets, The Relationship Between Quality of Healthcare and Racial Disparities in Medicare Health Plans, I think illustrates a couple of points. Number one is that when performance is transparent and public, people pay attention. The numbers that you see in that article reflect significant improvements overall for blacks and for whites. Now, this particular article focuses not on the processes. That was an earlier paper, something about salami science here, getting many papers out of one study. An earlier paper focused on improvements and equalization or near equalization for process measures. Did you order the right test for diabetes? Did you order the right test to check on bad cholesterol, that kind of stuff? This paper in your booklets talks about outcomes, and that's where you start to see some widening, which to me raises the question, how is it that the healthcare system can begin to partner with supports in the community and so forth? I also have to point out this little brochure in your books. We began working with 9 of the nation's largest health plans a couple of years ago, and they were simultaneously incredibly enthused about a joint collaborative effort to reduce disparities and also a little nervous, right? Because after all, nobody wants to announce that we're doing a terrible job here, but we're going to be working on it. That was a little bit, anxiety provoking. And most of the plans started off with a fairly discreet sort of project with the idea that if that worked, then they would try to roll it out across their plan. And they came to the conclusion that until they had data and could actually see performance across the entire population that they served, they weren't going to make substantial progress. So they are still working together. I often say that this is a research evaluation project for us. We want to learn which strategies work. But for them, it's core business, and they're taking it very, very seriously, which I find encouraging.
My button isn't as sensitive as Ed told me it would be. I guess I would like to agree with a lot of what Carolyn said. I think that what Peter said is true, that when people come to the Medicare program, they have a lifetime of healthcare experiences and interactions with the healthcare system that Medicare can't change at that point. That's history, and the question is what's going forward. So in some ways, you know, the Medicare program may be dealing with a baseline health status that's very challenging for the program. But I guess, you know, the question is that given that, what can Medicare do to try to even the playing field once the person enters the Medicare program? So that's one focus of our report. But I think our report also really did focus on Medicare's broader role in the system, what Medicare can do to provide incentives for healthcare providers, for example, to locate in areas with large numbers of low-income and people, low-income beneficiaries and people of color. How can, you know, Medicare really think about eliminating some of those geographic and perhaps socioeconomic differences in access to care? Also, you know, the recommendations about, you know, getting people into, you know, the, you know, Part B and all that sort of thing, I think are not insignificant for once the person gets into the Medicare program. But I think also Medicare's role in educating beneficiaries and their families will actually start to make changes in the overall healthcare system, because I think, you know, by educating beneficiary families, who often are the people who are, you know, sort of trying to navigate the healthcare system for the Medicare population, they'll learn things about how to access the healthcare system for themselves. I think that, you know, Medicare really taking this broad public education role, not just the broad role about educating providers and, you know, providing, you know, incentives and standards and that sort of thing for provider, institutional providers and for physicians. That's, I think, a too limited view of what Medicare can do, even with its current mandate.
One other thing, Renee, you had said, and then Peter amplified, that in some cases pursuing higher quality overall would exacerbate or had the potential to exacerbate the disparities in treatment. And I wonder if we heard an example from Carolyn of the opposite being true. Is there some easily graspable example or examples of it going in the other direction?
I wasn't trying to suggest that one thing versus the other would happen. I just was raising the issue that, just thinking about it from an administrative standpoint, if there are going to be targets set, it's theoretically possible that achieving one set of targets would cause you to have a shortfall on the other side. But Carolyn's absolutely right. In the dialysis program, the net quality improvement also led to a reduction in disparities. And that's terrific, and that really should be the model. But it's not assured. And that was all I was pointing out. And so, for example, you could argue that a pay-for-performance system, let's say, is rolled out amongst physicians or hospitals, as it's starting to be, and the goal is quality improvement. Well, would it be bad if hospitals where there were more white patients outperformed the hospitals where there were more black patients, but everyone improved? I don't think we would want to view that as a failure. I mean, I think it could be something that maybe could be tweaked or maybe adjusted wholesale, so that you see something even better. As Carolyn correctly notes, we need to have an equitable system, to have a high-quality system. But I was simply pointing out something, you know, having sat on the agency side, if you're told to do something or asked a request or the secretary has to do something, you do have these basic problems, like how do you achieve this and what's the trade-off and is it possible that you don't want the opposite unintended set of unintended consequences where the focus becomes reducing disparities and the easiest way to get there is lowering the quality of care for whites, right?
I think the opposite of the last thing you said is probably what's most likely to happen, because I think if you pay for incentives, the danger is, I mean, one analogy might be, and it might be an imperfect analogy, but to the No Child Left Behind, is that you then get incentives to weed the most difficult patients, the weakest students out of the system, and in an effort to try to elevate the overall numbers to meet the performance incentives goals. And that's a consequence that we don't want to happen. That's not going to leave people better off in the system than they are now, you know, having an uneducated kid or someone who has no doctor because the doctors are running away because it's not going to improve their performance numbers. So the question is then becomes, what's the performance that the system rewards? And the study that was in the New England Journal last week, is rewarding the highest quality and not necessarily closing the gap from where you were and making, you know, a big leap and improving quality overall. So I think it's not one or the other is going to be better, because you don't want to depress the performance at the top end either. But what you want to do is to try to have a system where both kinds of quality can be rewarded. And that takes quality improvement can be rewarded, reducing disparities and improving overall performance to some, you know, more objective level of excellence. So I think that, you know, the question is coming up with the resources to do both things.
We completely agree. And so I was pointing out a technical issue with it, but that's why I mentioned that, you know, risk adjusting patient populations, maybe even by race or ethnicity or socioeconomic status, would be a mechanistic way of doing exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. By the way, Carolyn made reference to several things that are in the packets, including the brochures from ARC and the report of the study panel, the full report of the study panel, which wouldn't fit into all of these packets. So if you didn't get one on the handout table in the back, I'd urge you to get one on the way out.
You can't have mine, though.
But you can't have hers, even though there are some great notes in the margins there. Yes, go ahead. I want to identify yourself.
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. I'm very pleased to see this discussion of Medicare and civil rights, because we usually don't talk about healthcare in a civil rights context. We usually talk about it strictly in a market-driven context. And it's very significant, as the panel mentioned, that the desegregation of the hospital system occurred when Medicare said that as a condition of participation, hospitals had to desegregate. And sure enough, within a few months, most of the hospitals in the country desegregated, including in the South. But what we also see is that political compromises were made so that the non-discrimination standards were only applied to hospitals, and Medicare doctors were excluded from having to meet those non-discrimination requirements. In other words, the hospital had to meet them, but doctors were not viewed as recipients of federal financial assistance, even though they were getting paid by Medicare. This fiction, unfortunately, interferes with the Health and Human Services Department applying non-discrimination standards to the healthcare delivery system.
Now, you're getting to a question here.
The question is coming. The inequalities that Peter has identified in his research, where minorities often go to poorer hospitals, I'm curious how we are going to address that problem through a pay-for-performance incentive to providers, or even to hospitals, when some hospitals are much more have better facilities than others. How are we going to address this underlying institutionalized inequality?
Well, let me just say, Bob, that I think that you're underscoring what's going to be a very significant strategic policy issue for incentives programs. Several studies that have been published have shown that these were just natural experiments, you know, comparing one group of doctors, for example, that got some kind of financial reward for better quality with those who didn't. And they've found, not terribly different from the study published last week, that there were significant improvements bordering on clinically meaningful. not huge improvements, but definitely in the right direction, and that most of the improvement came in the physician side from those who are already doing really well. I mean, that's where most of the reward went. Most of the improvement came from physicians who weren't doing so well before. So I think, I'm just restating what Peter said earlier, the question becomes, to what extent do you reward achieving some threshold of performance, and to what extent do you hold some resources aside to reward improvement, and how much improvement does that have to be, and so forth. I think it's also important to note, given the ambitious aims of the NASI study, which I think is fabulous, is that right now, in the public or private sectors, the amount of resources on the table for incentive programs is relatively modest, particularly compared to the overall payment system. So you could achieve a wonderful sort of split in allocation there, if you will, but it might not be enough resources, particularly at the physician practice level, because remember that two-thirds of patients in this country are seen by doctors in groups of five people or less. These are not units or entities with a lot of infrastructure, to put it mildly.
Hi, I'm Olga Pierce from United Press International, and I guess my question is, if we assume that there are things that Medicare can and should be doing, I'm wondering if each of the people on the panel could point out maybe one or two things that are doable soon that we should start looking at.
Well, I think the data collection piece is key. I think that's what we've been saying all along, you know, all of us on the panel, that better data will give us a better idea of, you know, what exactly are the problems and how to go about solving them. I also think, as I said in the response to the earlier question, you know, public education is just a really important thing. I mean, its payoff is not going to be immediate, but this is not a problem. This has been a problem that's, you know, 150 years in the making in the culture, and so looking for instantaneous and overnight results is not going to solve the problem. So I think public education is a tremendously important piece.
Well, if you're a clinician seeing patients, you learn something very, very early, and that is that patients who speak up and make noise tend to get listened to. If there's one experience that I think we could build upon right now, it's been the enormous outreach that went on across this country for enrolling people in and trying to help them figure out the choices they had to make for Medicare Part D. Regardless of where you stand on that, you have to acknowledge that this was a huge public effort where people across the country sat down at tables in churches and community centers and the whole nine yards, you know, across the table from folks to explain to them what was up. I think that's an enormous experience to build upon. And because I do think that patients who are more empowered and engaged in their own, what happens to their own health and health care, do have an enormous advantage. It's much, much easier to say that than to make it happen. But again, I think we've got all this concrete experience to build on. And I think we need to be figuring out how to do a lot more work with churches and other resources who can also be part of the solution here.
Go ahead, Peter.
I already mentioned my two. One being that I think that there's a lot more mileage on the language translation and services for deaf patients and other people with language communication impairments that could be gotten with the current regulations in place. And the other is that in thinking about quality measurement in the physician office and the hospitals, that appropriate risk adjustment, demographic adjustment, and neighborhood level adjustment, things like that, will go a long way towards ensuring that the game doesn't get played in a way that adversely affects the underserved.
A couple of years ago, when we were talking about this topic, Aetna had just launched an effort to collect racial and ethnic data, and we're met with a fair amount of resistance from the minority community. And I wonder, in either in your partnerships with the plans or in the experience of the other panelists, that has either diminished or turned around.
Aetna is part of the collaborative that we've been working with, and their experience has been very, very instructive. It was slow at first. I think they've made it incredibly clear to people who are already enrolled that this information will not be misused, that it's voluntarily provided. As I understand it, most patients do this now through a portal. And after sort of very slow progress, suddenly there's been, not suddenly, but over the past year or two, there's been great increases in the number of people who are participating. You don't have to. And I think they're very, very careful to assure folks that the information won't be misused.
The new data that docs are supposed to submit in order to get the 1.5% bonus, does it allow the collection of racial and ethnic and economic data?
I believe that would all just come from the Medicare enrollment files, which come from Social Security.
Okay, very good. We have a question here and then in the back.
Yes, my name is Ruth Perot. I'm the Executive Director and CEO of Summit Health Institute for Research and Education. I want to commend the panel. I must express some disagreement with Dr. Beck's dichotomy. If, in fact, we're looking at through the lens of justice and equity, the choice of which you address, disparities or quality, it would seem to be fairly clear. We simply can't perpetuate that pattern of inequity, as I see it. I rise with some mixed feelings. Our organization put together a report published by the Commonwealth Fund in 2001 that zeroed in on some of the very same findings and recommendations that the National Academy found. We did another report commissioned by CMS in 2003, found the same kinds of patterns and issues, and made the same recommendations and findings. And now it is 2006. Is someone tone deaf here? I'm trying to get a sense of what do you feel are the obstacles in getting these kinds of recommendations implemented, knowing how important the data issue is. The very same observations that you have made in this most recent report, and I'm concerned.
And this reminds me of the conversations we have all the time about, you know, reform and access to the judicial system and things like that. The problems seem to not be solved from one generation to the next. And I think part of the answer is that the problems and difficulties having to do with race and ethnicity are problems that the entire culture hasn't solved, and the healthcare system is very much part and parcel of that culture. And we can't actually, even though at some level you might want to expect a better result there, but you know, it's people who are living in the culture who have to implement these changes, and I think that's part of the problem. That's the pessimistic answer. But I do think that there is some value, though, in all the studies coming out and saying the same thing. I mean, at some point, there's a choir and a chorus there that can't be ignored, and I think that's the real advantage in continuing to do it. I don't think it can be frustrating, but I do think that the multiple voices, make a louder noise, as Carolyn was saying, and maybe the system will listen. I think also, I don't want to say that the problems are so hard they can't be solved, but they are hard. So bureaucracies, I used to be part of the same bureaucracy. Bureaucracies like to find the easy solution that will make people in the Congress and happy and will make the headline writers happy, right? And so taking on a difficult problem like this isn't necessarily going to, make either group happy with you, in the next appropriation cycle. But I do think that, like with all things in public policy, this is a long speech, I'm sorry, but we need to take a longer view, that we're not asking that tomorrow that we expect that everything will suddenly be fixed, but that somebody has got to start and has got to start to measure and has got to start to focus. Otherwise, we will be having the same conversation 10 years from now, and that will be that really tragic, not only that we have to keep having the same conversation, but because there will be a lot of people who will have died or who will be impaired because they didn't get the right health care, and that's what the real tragedy is for not doing something about this problem.
First, I need to say for Ruth, what she couldn't say on her own behalf, the reports that she led were spectacular. So if you haven't seen them, they're definitely worth looking at. Ruth, I think part of the problem is less that people don't recognize the issue now, but that describing the problem is much easier than solving it, which is why I had a point on a slide about local solutions. Now, the problem with that is that gets the right people on the ground together who need to address the problem in the District of Columbia or Maryland or Virginia or whatever. It doesn't it doesn't fit nicely into broad legislative language, which tends to be a little bit easier to tailor when you've got a very specific solution that will fit everywhere. I'm less convinced that that's the case. What I hear from physicians a lot is, tell me what to do. Tell me which piece of this problem I own and which piece of this problem I need to hook up with others or partner with others to figure out how they can be helpful here too. I know that I'm telling my patients in some cases what to do and it's the right thing and it's not happening. So how do I work with others to make it happen?
Yes, in the back. Oh,
yes.
Yes, go ahead.
My name is Deborah Reed, and I'm from the National Health Law Program. My question is directed toward Renee Landers. You mentioned during your presentation that the issue of reducing racial and ethnic health disparities should be addressed through a civil rights enforcement perspective. I was wondering if you could tell us what are the benefits of using that approach. I agree, just incidentally. But what are the benefits of using that approach? And also, can you also tell us what are some of the mechanisms that are currently being underutilized in civil rights that could help in addressing this, these disparities?
That's a good question, because I didn't want to get, you know, to focus on that part of the report unless people were interested. But we've talked about it a little bit in two different ways. I think that I think the reason that it's beneficial to have civil rights enforcement as a part of the toolbox in solving this problem is that there are some people, some institutions that only respond to coercive threats, right? And I think we know this on the payment side of the Medicare system, right? That people didn't really pay as much attention as they should have to the billing rules until the Office of the Inspector General and the Justice Department got really serious about enforcing the anti-kickback statute, and in some cases the Stark statute. That gets people's attention. Treble damages get people's attention, right? As soon as it costs them money. So part of me thinks that there's always a certain part of the world that only responds to that kind of incentive, negative though it may be. So I think it's really important to have it out there. I think that after the movement to the requirement that hospitals desegregate at this beginning of the Medicare program in the 1960s, that I used to work at this agency too, HHS's enforcement efforts on civil rights front have been fairly weak. There have been not a lot of resources devoted to it, and not, you can certainly think of only a few high-profile enforcement actions over the last several years that, you know, maybe the last 10 years, 20 years, that really have captivated the public attention. And so I think it's an underutilized tool. Now, there is a danger because I do think that, as Carolyn said, and as Peter has pointed out, you know, a lot of doctors are well-intentioned. They don't know what to do, and maybe we all think they should know what to do and what their role is. But the fact of the matter is that they don't, and it may be, largely inadvertent. So I'm not trying to label the behavior. I'm just trying to see the consequence and figure out what's a good solution. And some of the behavior might be intentional race discrimination, and the legal system and HHS should be a part of using those tools to solve it. I think one barrier on the physician side, as the gentleman in the front of the room pointed out earlier, is that fiction has been adopted that even though hospitals are receiving payments from the same Medicare program that the physicians are receiving payments from, the hospitals are providing, you know, public accommodation services, and the physicians aren't, and they're not receiving federal financial assistance in the way that hospitals are, and therefore the legal standard for going after the physician behavior is a much more difficult legal standard. So one possible change is for HHS to take a different view of that statute, or for Congress to amend the statute so that it's clear that physicians also are receiving federal financial assistance. So there are some statutory tweaks. Also, this one final point on the legal analysis that a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case in which it said it held that only the government could go after disparate impact racial discrimination cases, and that private There was no private right of action to go after disparate impact cases, only intentional discrimination cases. And I think that's another tremendous barrier, and that's a core decision. It was not a constitutional decision that Congress could overturn. So that's another statutory change that would need to happen in order to make it easier for ordinary people to bring litigation against institutions that have sort of a problem in this area that's a disparate impact problem and not necessarily an intentional discrimination problem.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Bill Clark. I'm with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Two questions. The first one is Congress in the Medicare Modernization Act passed a provision I think that's commonly referred to as Welcome to Medicare benefit, which I think is an intriguing, has potential with respect to the concept of the medical home for those people who do enter Medicare. I assume that Congress, in passing that provision, recognized that there could be a lot of unmet need by people who when they first became eligible for Medicare, who may not have had previous sources of health insurance, and this was a way to try to assure that people would find someone to see early on and get a comprehensive screening kind of an assessment and then go forward from there. My understanding, though, is that that benefit applies the standard rules for Medicare cost sharing, so that there's a barrier, initial financial barrier to access to that, even that initial preventive visit, because they must meet the deductible and cost sharing requirements of Medicare. And I'm wondering if there might be a way to tweak that benefit a little bit to either incentivize people to stay with a provider for 90 days or waive that fee in some way. That would be a coster, I would think, to simply do away with it. But if there's some way to incentivize the use of the medical home, taking the medical home concept and applying that in the already passed Welcome to Medicare benefit. That's question one. Question two is the Balanced Budget Act passed a provision that enabled states to pay lower cost sharing for Medicare with respect to dual eligible beneficiaries, so that they would reimburse the Medicare provider based on the prevailing, I believe it's 75% of the state's fee that they would charge for the same service. In some cases, that meant that there were $0 that were being paid by states to Medicare providers. And I'm wondering what the panelists felt about what impact that might have on disparities. Thank you.
Good questions. Peter, you want to try?
So the first one is about the Welcome to Medicare visit. I mean, that's just a good idea. I don't really know what to say other than that. I think you're right about the cost sharing. I think the uptake of the Welcome to Medicare visit has been a little bit more sluggish than Congress anticipated, but the belief is that a lot of that is conversion to E&M visits in the context of a Welcome to Medicare visit, because problems are discovered which are billable and actually raises a level of reimbursement. But I don't know. If there is going to be a medical home in Medicare, it would certainly take more than that, not the least of which reasons is because Welcome to Medicare is only the first 6 months for people entering the program, so you'd still have the 40-some-odd million people floating around who are already in the program, so you'd need some other vehicle other than that. And there's been a fair amount of talk about using things like the referring provider UPIN number on the Medicare claims as a way of default assigning medical home and things like that, but there'd need to be more than that. The other thing you comment about Medicaid is you're right. That's the math. I don't think it's clear what the impact is on services. It's very clear in oncology that it's had an effect on drug reimbursement, and some of these drugs in cancer are extremely expensive. And given the structure of the ASP plus 6 system, it's left doctors underwater on those patients specifically for particularly high-priced biologics. And that's a challenge. I don't believe that Medicare has the discretion to address that without congressional movement on it, and that could presumably affect people's access to particularly high-priced therapies.
Okay. Got a question here. Got a question there. Go ahead.
I'm Rick Blake. I'm the Senior Health Policy Advisor to Congressman Towns. We sit on the Subcommittee on Health on the Energy and Commerce Committee. As you were well aware, you're not holding this discussion in political absentia. So the Senate probably will redrop what we consider a weak health disparities bill. And we on the House side are, and well, P people in here in particular are going to recraft the health disparities bill. So one, I wanted to welcome any of you in here wanted to inform the House bill to get in contact with me. And then two, since CMS is here, I can't resist. The President's health plan is going to have a great impact on health disparities, probably in our view negatively. And particularly New York City and New York State hospitals are going to suffer greatly if the Medicaid payment streams are affected the way it seems that they will be. Some of this dialogue is, I think, long term, I just want you all to realize that we don't have forever. Thank you.
So here's your opportunity.
Yep, there's your opportunity.
Tell them what to put in the bill. I'm sure you're going to get suggestions from a number of people in the audience and on the panel. And good luck getting to yes on that. Yes.
I'm Lisa Summers with the American College of Nurse Midwives, and I actually know Rick's name, but I hadn't put a face to his name. And the congressman is actually sponsoring a bill that would. But that's not what I got up here to say. But I did want to say, related question, that I noticed that Dr. Clancy used the term clinician several times, and on Renee's slides, there's a reference to providers. And I think it underscores a subtle but I think very important point that a vast amount of the care that's provided in this country to the underserved and the communities that we've been talking about is in fact provided by nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, folks other than physicians. And there's very often there are policy and structural decisions that are made that set up barriers. It's a financially driven healthcare system, and physicians have been traditionally very powerful in the system. So I think it's just important to underscore that as these kinds of policy decisions are made, that when we think about providers, we think about providers as a very large group. And you talked about the importance of the speech-language hearing issues. The speech-language hearing folks are part of a coalition of non-physician providers that have been working very hard on issues like pay for performance. So I appreciate that being recognized subtly, and I just wanted to say, you know, very publicly that we do in fact appreciate when that distinction is made and there are decisions made that facilitate care being provided by those groups of people.
Okay. We've got a question that relates back to an earlier comment about cultural competency. No one really talked about Medicare's role in increasing such competency, the questioner writes, or the role that cultural beliefs play in how minorities seek care or perceptions of the care they receive. Perhaps Medicare can work to educate patients on how and when to seek care and to advocate for quality care. Also, Medicare could work through graduate medical education at increasing physician workforce diversity and therefore cultural competency. And I guess there's a question at the end of that says, don't you agree?
Well, we certainly agree in our report with all of those points. So I think that goes without saying. I think this sort of relates back to one of the comments Carolyn made about, you know, Aetna's slow efforts at first in trying to collect racial and ethnic data from its subscribers, because I think that there are different cultural conventions about when it's appropriate to seek help of any kind, and including healthcare, and also deep suspicion among some minority and racial groups about the healthcare system because they have been misused by it in the past. And memories of these unfortunate experiences, you know, are very long. And so I think that there is a lot to be done here to try to really change that perception. But the reality has to be there to meet the new expectations. So we can't, you know, sort of send people in and then, you know, have them disappointed by the outcome. The quality has to be there if we get them to the door.
I would agree with that, and I do think that patient empowerment and activation is critically important, and notice how easily I said that. That is much, much easier for people who are well-educated and know what questions to ask and feel that they have the confidence and the skills to simply go in and say, I'm not sure I agree, or I need to hear more, and so forth. Mind you, I'm fully aware that for many people of all backgrounds, this is an increasing challenge in healthcare today, so I don't want to walk away from that. But I do think it's a particular problem for people who are not well-educated and who are poor, which is why I was very excited to meet a woman this weekend who's a physician working with an interdenominational effort to try to figure out how to bring that support through churches. I don't want to say that they own the whole situation. I'm just recognizing that it is a challenge to follow up on a recommendation that speaking up on your own behalf for your own health and health care or for a loved one or family member, friend, is really important, but knowing how to do it is really important too, and we've got to figure that out.
I agree completely with what Carolyn's just said, that better information for patients and their families is clearly a necessity for navigating this system as it currently stands, and there's every reason to work very hard to do that in every possible venue and vehicle that we have and appropriately translated and the rest of it. I do differ with this sort of unspoken supposition that the problem, one reason that minority patients don't receive as good care as non-minorities is because physicians and other providers discriminate between patients based on race or ethnicity. The data for that, and I'm just being empirical, is weak at best. And in fact, the data suggests, I believe, that most of the disparity in care after you adjust for differences in income have to do with between provider differences, not within provider differences. And the Trivedis study notwithstanding, that's health plans across the country, so it isn't really at the level of granularity that's needed. But there is an implicit, and I'm a physician, and there's an implicit suggestion that doctors are discriminating because they don't know how to talk to patients or understand patients from different cultural backgrounds. That may be correct. If true, we should pour massive resources into addressing that. But first, we need empiric evidence before we go down a road which may not yield a great deal of fruit, even though it makes us feel like we're doing the right thing. And I think that would be a terrible mistake. We do have limited resources. We do have a limited number of lessons we can sort of spell out and lay out and preach to patients and doctors. And we have a very, very limited number of carrots and essentially no sticks. So it would be a real mistake, I think, to decide that the epidemiologic or mathematical explanation for disparities are within the physician or within the provider if they're not. And that because the solutions are just fundamentally different. And that doesn't mean I don't think these things are important for other broader social goals, but my biggest objective is to actually just improve the quality of care that patients get, irrespective of their race or ethnicity, and I think we need to take the most targeted approach to that, even if it's not the one that feels the most politically correct.
Okay. We have 10 to 15 minutes left here, and I just want you to pull that blue evaluation form out and start filling it out so you won't forget as we get to the rush at the end. Meantime, we have another questioner in the back of the room.
My name is Miranda Franco. I'm with the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. I actually asked this question in regard to a thesis I'm currently working on this topic. There seems to be a great deal of research on race and class as a combined component, but there's not much on kind of race as a proxy for class. And hypothetically, if racial discrimination didn't exist, would these disparities still exist just based on one's class? And all the data efforts seem to be based on collecting that type of information as a combined component. And I was wondering if there's anything that Medicare is working on doing is looking at those distinctly to see if we could collect data on those as two different issues and see how that would affect the disparities that exist. Thanks.
I don't speak for Medicare or for the administration. There are inherent, if by class what you mean is economic standing, there's limited information, and that was, of course, one of the issues with rolling out Part D was identifying the people who were eligible for limited income subsidy as a consequence of that. But I do think that some of the research has tried to tease apart at least the effects of socioeconomic status from the effects of race or ethnicity, and there's been some movement on that, but there are problems with attribution, sensitivity and specificity, and geographic measures of socioeconomic status, which are imperfect. And there's lots of methodologic challenges, but I don't think it would be fair to characterize at least the research as bundling them. I think most of the research, certainly the stuff in the packet, has attempted to separate. But there are great challenges in doing that methodologically.
Well, let me just add to that for 1 minute. You're completely right, so I wish you really a lot of good luck with this thesis, that we don't have very good data on class and economic standing in particular. I will also just note, though, that it's a very, very sensitive topic. There have been some very interesting studies conducted by the Cancer Institute where patients were willing to provide all kinds of fairly intimate details about their physical functioning, and I won't get into specifics. But when it came to the income question, they would leave it blank. So they were more willing to admit in this particular example information about demographics and so forth. I think one open question is how much precision do we need? We certainly need enough precision to be able to get good empirical evidence for the right solutions. At the same time, boy, we know an awful lot now about who are the subgroups at highest risk of poor quality to begin testing solutions.
Well, the other fact is that right now, lower economic class status is associated with race, that the income disparities among racial groups persist. And so it's fine to say separate the two, but I think that there is a substantial overlap, even if you were. I mean, I think that that's what the studies have basically pushed to that conclusion. So I don't think that the two are, I think you're right, that the two are very much related.
I've got a question that's addressed on the card anyway to Carolyn Clancy regarding pediatric asthma, since you brought up pediatric asthma. To what extent does ARC have an ability and interest in exploring research based on survey data linked at the individual level to Medicaid or SCHIP? And what sort of knowledge investment would be appropriate for Congress and HHS to consider for this kind of research?
Well,
not exactly a Medicare question, I would
say. That's right. Let me just say it's a topic we're very, very interested in. For a number of years, researchers have been looking at a phenomenon called avoidable hospitalizations. In fact, the whole idea for measuring hospitalizations that are potentially avoidable started right here in the District of Columbia when a researcher who was doing work for DC General noticed that there were an awful lot of people in the waiting room who were being readmitted. And it turned out, of course, that many of these patients who were leaving the hospital, patients with chronic illnesses, leaving the hospital with superb, flawless discharge instructions, except they had nowhere to go. So I actually think if you look in the report, you will see that there are big variations in potentially avoidable hospitalizations related to pediatric asthma. They are at the highest rate for African American children. Moreover, the variation between the states is quite remarkable. So the state with the highest number of potentially avoidable admissions for pediatric asthma is 5 times higher than the state with the lowest number. That suggests to me a very, very important opportunity for learning. So whoever asked the question, consider us engaged and interested.
One of the programs that I mentioned, at the Boston Medical Center, the Medical Legal Partnership Program, is aimed exactly at that problem. That it does the physician no good to prescribe, the right medications, the right home care, and all of that if the person can't afford the prescription. There's wall-to-wall carpeting in the home, the shag carpeting that the landlord won't remove for the child with asthma. So these things need different kind of interventions. The healthcare system alone can't solve the problem that's contributing to the poor healthcare outcome. And so that's why an investment in a multidisciplinary kind of approach to solving some of these things is really important to improve healthcare outcomes.
Thank you.
Time for a quick question.
My name is Kristen Southers. I'm from the American Public Health Association. And I actually just have more of a comment, but also I guess a question. With what Dr. Bach was saying earlier about within provider differences, I really question the research on cultural competency and physicians' attitudes towards patients, because much of it is self-report. And you're in this type of research, you're essentially asking a provider to look at their own behavior and decide whether or not they're behaving in a racist or biased way. And if you want to talk about political correctness, the responses that people would give on those kinds of surveys would be, extremely biased. So I understand what you were saying about in a world of limited resources, we need to figure out, you know, which goals are the most important. But I also urge you not to let go of this one really important area because, you know, I attend a lot of health disparities, racial health disparities seminars, and most of the time, you know, I'm in the minority because I'm a white person, and I think there should be a lot more white people around the table because we are part of the problem. So I just urge you not to let go within provider issues.
Thanks for the comment, and I just want to clarify, I'm just raising skepticism about this as a possible explanation. I didn't suggest at all that we should let go of it. Just that if you look at the empiric data, and it's not just survey research, it's also analyses done at the level of the provider, the empiric evidence does not support that the primary driver, or even a large proportion of the source of disparities are at the provider level. So does it mean that it may not be a good vehicle? I don't know. Is it cost effective to pursue it? I don't know. But I just want to raise some skepticism about it because I do think there's a danger in the groupthink around this theory of cultural competency and that racism and discrimination drive disparities. Like I said, my objective, just as a physician in the healthcare system, is to improve the quality of care that patients receive, irrespective of their race. And I think social equity is an excellent objective. But I don't think we should assume, you know, and I have to, if I can back up for half a second, and I know I should give a quick response. I was the author of the study in 1999 that showed that the difference in surgery between blacks and whites for lung cancer was responsible for the survival gap between blacks and whites, and watched that be picked up by the media and be picked up by people here in D.C. as evidence that blacks were being discriminated against by their doctors. And we looked at our data that night when we started to hear people saying that, and we realized that all the black patients were going to about 15% of the doctors, and all the whites were going to other doctors. And we realized that that couldn't possibly be the arithmetic explanation for what was going on. And so it was a little vexing to hear that explanation marched out when we suspected, although we didn't have the data at that time, that this was a system problem, and that blacks were going to facilities where the ambient rate of surgery was lower. The empiric data now suggests that that is a more likely explanation for major procedures, and it also suggests that maybe in some primary care spaces, it's also the major explanation. So do I think it makes sense? Sure. Do I think doctors are already perfectly trained to communicate with their patients about their problems? Not really. So, yeah, it's a good avenue to pursue, but we neither should put all of our eggs in that basket because I don't think arithmetically we'll solve the problem. Nor should we assume that the empiric evidence is sufficient right now to justify that course over alternatives because we do have limited resources and we do have a limited attention span we can take advantage of. And I think we need to use that in the most effective way possible to get what we want, which is better quality of care for patients who deserve the best that they can get.
Can I just add one other sort of gloss on this issue? I think that what Peter says about the structural problem is absolutely clear, because I think one of the things that Hurricane Katrina revealed was, and I think the Kaiser Foundation has really good stuff on its website about what the status of healthcare institutions in New Orleans was before the hurricane and, you know, now the disaster that's followed. But it was a healthcare system virtually in crisis before the hurricane hit, and largely based on socioeconomic status and race. And, you know, the people in the racial and ethnic minority groups were being seen at a small group of public hospitals where they were overwhelmed and they were, you know, really operating on fumes. You know, the financial resources they had available were very weak. But so that's a structural problem. And the question is, why does that structural problem persist? Why is it that the 15% of the physicians that were seen by these minority patients weren't referring them to surgery? What is it about? Why don't they have the right referral networks? Why don't they have access to the facilities where these surgeries can be performed? These kinds of questions. And I think I agree with Peter that I don't think discrimination is the explanation, or maybe even the majority explanation, sort of today at this moment in time, but that it is one explanation, and that we have to address that and the ability of people to communicate with each other, along with really drilling down on some of these other structural and financial barriers to achieving equity in healthcare.
Carolyn?
I was just going to make a point. It turns out to be pretty challenging to study communication between physicians and patients. So in the early 90s, a researcher who was then from Pittsburgh did a study at VA and found pretty significant disparities among veterans. So they're all insured, fairly similar social class, very significant disparities in receipt of cardiac care. Needless to say, this got a lot of people's attention, and he followed it up with a study of communication, and he, you know, gave the patients and the physicians questionnaires before and after the encounter. So when he presented this at a national meeting, I mean, to a totally packed room, and I know because I was behind the door, so every time someone came in, I realized that there were yet more people interested in these results. And the bottom line from this study was that all of the patients heard stuff that the doctors never said they said. There were no differences among black patients and white patients. You know, the patients were hearing in the case of bypass surgery that they were going to live much, much longer. The doctors all reported that they didn't say anything like that. So communication in healthcare needs a lot of work.
That is a pretty good way of ending this discussion. We're not done with this communication yet, and I hope that we can continue it. But I think we've taken a lot of strides forward in trying to sort out what some of the variables are here. And for that, I want to thank NACI, its staff, its study panel, and the supporters of its work. I want to thank the staff of the Alliance for working so hard and putting together a very good program, and ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for an extremely useful discussion.